Let's bring in our next guest. He is Harmon Dial of The Athletic Vancouver. Thanks for this, Harm. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
We're doing well, man. Thanks for making the time today. So, yeah, we've been trying to figure this out and kind of theorize how hockey changes. It's not like baseball where every play happens in isolation. So it's kind of hard to see where a drastic tactical change comes. Do you have any theories as to how hockey might evolve?
100%. I agree with that notion. I don't think you're going to see hockey ever evolve in a way where, if you watch baseball, for instance, the average fan can tell just because how drastically different in-game decisions are, that analytics has changed the sport. I don't think that's going to be as prevalent or as noticeable for the casual fan in hockey. I think you'll see slight tweaks here and there. I look to, for example, in the early 2010s, there was research done that showed that entering the offensive zone with possession, so carrying it in, was twice as likely to generate offense as dumping it in. So that was one example where, from that point on, I think most teams, and I think if you compare a lot of the zone entry data from 2010 or sort of the 2012, 13, 14, that sort of time range to now, what you'll notice is that generally the league as a whole does enter the zone with possession more often than they used to. And I think that's just a slight tweak, though. Like, it isn't something that, unless you're looking at the data, unless you're kind of really paying attention, that you would have been able to notice. And the key there, too, is it's not a black and white rule, because you have teams like the Islanders, like the Flyers, that can still play the dump and chase style effectively. And it just goes to show you that when it comes to, I think, analytics, there's never going to be like there may be general guidelines or rules of thumb for how you may want to approach certain tactics or certain puck possession theories, but it's never going to be a hard and fast rule. And so beyond zone entries, I think the other areas where you may see continued slight tweaks is the continued emphasis on puck possession. So that means, and we've seen it a lot, where the stay-at-home defenseman that is just out there to throw hits and is slow and can't move the puck, that player has kind of been phased out, as have enforcers. So I think really the thing with analytics is, I don't think it's changed a lot in isolation. I don't think it's going to change a lot in isolation. I think it affects more player evaluation than anything. And the funny thing is, it coincides with the league just generally moving faster, right? So a lot of these changes, for instance, the puck moving defenseman thing that I mentioned, or how goons are being phased out, I don't think that's necessarily as much to do with analytics as it is just the league is getting faster. And I think teams and decision makers are realizing that. So I think moving forward, one thing that you may see from a tactical perspective is, we'll be able to, with puck tracking, see tendencies for how teams attack as far as patterns, right? Like how teams maybe attack the middle, use the wings, how defensemen get involved in the rush. So you may see teams sort of start to game plan more specifically against offenses using that. But I don't think you're going to see any major systems changes. I think more than anything, you may see changes to how personnel are viewed. And again, that's just more roster construction than it is actually changing how you view the game and the product that's on the ice.
Well, the timing is interesting as well, because you mentioned puck tracking, and baseball's had so much data and so many resources going back decades now, whereas hockey is at the beginning of that arc in a lot of ways. It's having the information is the key, and you're going to get a lot more coming in starting very soon here, Harm, but what you do with it, there's limits to what you can do with in hockey, but the timing with puck tracking, I think reading the information and then seeing all these sources are going to be really interesting, because we've never seen this in hockey before, have we?
For sure, we haven't. And the other thing with hockey, and this is pretty obvious, is just because of how fluid and dynamic it is as a sport, there aren't defined possessions, even like there are in basketball, right? And we know that in baseball, as you mentioned, every sort of play happens in isolation. That doesn't really happen in hockey. And so I think even when things like puck tracking come into effect, I think more than anything, it's going to help us learn more about specific players than it will changing sport. So for instance, evaluating which players are good defensively is usually pretty difficult. I think you can obviously tell just by watching the game, but as far as objectively, being able to quantify that, it's sometimes been difficult. And I look at someone like Jared Spurgeon in Minnesota, for example. He's an undersized defenseman, but he's so good in his own end. And I think he's an example of a player where he kind of slipped through the cracks as an undrafted free agent, signed with Minnesota, and he's evolved into becoming one of the league's best defensemen. You're going to see inefficiencies like that, I think, start to, they're just not going to be prevalent anymore, and you're going to be able to realize players of that archetype that perform well. And even, again, with player and puck tracking specifically, things like positioning, right? Things like players that are able to get their sticks in lanes. And you're just going to learn so much more about defense is the biggest thing that I think you're going to learn a lot about. And because offensively, we already have a lot of information for how we can evaluate. We can look at players, how many passes they make that lead to shots. We can look at their entries. We can look at obviously how often they shoot and all these tendencies. But defensively, I think, is where you're going to see the biggest lessons learned. And again, I think it's going to apply more towards learning about specific players than it is going to necessarily overhaul the game as a whole.
Yeah, I guess the one area it could truly affect is potentially goalies. And I guess we've seen that already, Harm, but you know, that's the one position where we can look at usage and how it affects a player, how it affects their effectiveness. You know, we've seen that with the usage of goalies on back-to-backs and threes and fours and how you mix that up. And other than that, I don't see really too much that can change. You know, maybe we'll see more and more teams go to a total split sort of identity between their goalies where, like Boston, you're seeing Rask and Halak play 41 games each in a season.
For sure. I think there's also been some research out there, though, that the back-to-back, some of the initial research may be overrated just how taxing it can be. But you bring up a good point as far as goalies as a whole, because I think the biggest factor there is it's so hard to evaluate goaltending because just there are so many variables out there. And it's so difficult to account for the defense in front of these netminders and being able to track things like passes across the slot, backdoor plays, screens, tips, deflections. And we don't have access to any of that data right now. And that's why you have situations where, you know, you may look at a goalie save percentage and that doesn't really help you. Like, stats aren't really, at least from my perspective, I can't really lean on them a whole lot sometimes when I'm evaluating goaltenders. And that's where really, at this stage anyway, you have to rely on people that really know the position well. Someone like Ian Clark, for instance, I feel can look at a goalie and he's going to be able to pick up so much more about his potential fit in a different system than we do just with data. And that's one area where I think with skaters, forwards, and defensemen, data has really helped and analytics has really helped us learn a lot about these players. But goalies are just one area where we haven't been able to understand just because it's so difficult to account for the defensive environment in front of those netminders. So I think we're going to learn a lot more about that, and I think it definitely is going to aid the evaluation. Because, for instance, you look at Robin Lehner, who's obviously with Vegas right now. When he was initially having a lot of success with the Islanders, there were a lot of people who doubted his success and said, okay, well, can he replicate that in a chaotic defensive environment? Like, is he legitimately a good goaltender, or is he just benefiting from a defensive system that takes away quality chances? And so we've seen from Lehner in one case that he has done well elsewhere. And I think those sorts of dilemmas you're going to maybe get a little bit more clarity on as far as how goaltenders may fare in different systems.
You're listening to Reach Deeper, joined by Harmon Dial of The Athletic. And Harm, free agency has kind of come and gone here. I know there's a bunch of players that haven't been signed yet, but still, from a Canucks perspective, we have a pretty good idea what this team's going to look like next year. We've been debating the depth, or as I see it, lack of depth. But When you talk about those wing positions on the back end, is that something to worry about, or are the Canucks okay internally with the Yalevis of the world, the Rafferty's, and others?
I think with the back end, obviously the top four has gotten stronger, but I do think the bottom pair is in a position where if one of these prospects don't step up, it is going to be weaker, because I think Stetcher was the ideal number five defenseman as someone who was really solid in his own end, could move the puck a little bit. He wasn't obviously the most flashy player, but he could also step up into the top four if an injury came up. And now you're looking at a situation where I think the most, if opening night of the regular season was tomorrow, I think you'd see a Ulevi-Ben pairing. And I think when you contrast that to what the Canucks had last season, that's definitely a downgrade. I do think one of the prospects, whether it's Ulevi, Rathbone, Rafferty, Chatfield, I think one of them, there's a pretty good chance they can be a quality number six. But I do think you need another sort of number five. And I think the Canucks internally feel the same way, where if you could somehow get an upgrade on Ben and get someone who can just anchor the bottom pairing and sort of be that veteran force to kind of bring the rookie along and sort of take that pressure off, I think it would really help the development of whoever is sort of able to emerge among the Comets' group of defensemen. So I am a little bit worried about the depth on the back end, particularly you've got to remember in the top four, someone like Alex Sedler is really prone to injuries. If he goes down as a left shot, who slots into your top four? Are you looking at Ulevi? Are you looking at Ben? You don't want to be in that sort of situation. So there's that factor to consider. And then obviously with the forward group and its depth, I do think you have to be concerned, because let's look at it this way. Jake Virtanen is currently battling Louis Erickson for a top six role. And just the fact that Erickson is even in the discussion, like let's hypothetically say Virtanen doesn't, for whatever reason, pan out in top line role. He's back in third line duties. Travis Green's most likely decision from that point on, if you look at his other options like McEwen, like Hauerluck, is going to be to bump Bess up to the top line and bring Louis back onto the second line. And so I think that tells you everything you need to know about the right wing depth. The fact that Louis Erickson still factors into the team's plans. I think they're short on a top six winger on the right side for sure. And so I think when you step back and look at this team, you know they have the elite nucleus. You know guys like Pettersson and Hughes are going to be game changers. That top-end talent is going to power this squad, particularly on the man advantage. But absolutely, I think the bottom six last year, again, was bottom five in the NHL as far as five-on-five goal differential. They got outscored really badly, and same thing with the bottom pair. So I don't think the depth is any better than it was when the team left the bubble, and so to me it's still a concern.
Before I let you go, I was interested at The Athletic, your top 10 free agents that were still available, and Andreas Athanasiou was not a part of it. This is a guy that just last season scored 27 even strength goals. What's the knock on Athanasiou?
Well, he was definitely in the honorable mentions. I sort of parsed through that, and you could make a for me, the reason I didn't have him there was I think he's a classic example of an empty calorie scorer. And that's to say he racks up goals and points individually, but he doesn't actually help your team a whole lot as far as winning games, because I think there are two major knocks on him. One is defensively. He's one of the worst defensive players in the league. And so anytime you have that relationship, and we've seen it in Vancouver with Jake Virtanen, it significantly decays a player's value. And beyond just the defensive side of things, there's the offensive side where his point totals flatter his offensive impact. Because if you look at Athanasiou's profile, yes, he scores goals, yes, he scores points, but the problem is any line that he's on, if you look at their actual goal scoring rate, the line as a whole is scoring less goals with Athanasiou on it, right? So it's one of those situations where Athanasiou gets his own share of the pie, but the five-man unit as a whole isn't actually scoring more. And it's because he kind of cannibalizes the offense He's top 50 in the league in terms of shot attempts, and he's a pure rush player. So what tends to happen is he generates a ton of volume as far as he's going to take a ton of attempts off the rush. And so from time to time, he is going to score his own, but a lot of those chances are one and done. And because of that, it negatively impacts his teammates. And so while Athanasio may get his own scoring chances, may get his own offense, his line mates suffer. And so on the whole, if you're looking at a player, again, who is able to score a lot, but his teammates are very negatively impacted, both defensively and offensively, I think that's a perfect example of an empty calorie scorer. And so because of that, I think he needs to be someone who maybe flourishes on a sheltered scoring line. And I really do think he's kind of similar to Bertan in that sort of way, as far as being a guy who can absolutely fly, create a lot off the rush, but he's a little bit of a one-and-done player, makes poor decisions, and Athanasio ultimately, I don't think the bottom line is commensurate, and I don't think it really aligns with his point totals, which I think look a lot better than his actual impact.
Harm, always appreciate the time, man. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me.
There is Harmon Dial.